Hello everyone and welcome to the Loopcast. I'm Chelsea Damon and today we're going to have a talk on North Korea. Of course, there's a lot of news on North Korea at the moment in US news as well as international news. So I think this is a great timely show. And today we have for our guest David Maxwell. So first of all, thank you for coming on the show, Mr. Maxwell.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
For our listeners, David Maxwell is the Associate Director of the Center for Security Studies and the Security Studies Program in the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. And among his many accomplishments, he is also a 30-year veteran of the U.S. Army, retiring as a Special Forces Colonel. So you have a much broader and greater background, but I don't want to have to go on and on because we've got such an interesting topic to dive in for today's show. So to start off, why don't we just discuss shortly what the current situation with North Korea is?
Well, that's a great question. And of course, as we watch the news, we see that tensions are high. North Korea just conducted its sixth nuclear test. And in the last really 10 months, a large number of missile tests, various missile tests. And of course, with the election of Donald Trump, and as well as the election of President Moon in May, the situation now is really in flux. There has been a lot of rhetoric on both sides. And I think that North Korea, while they may be on the rhetorical offensive, just as some might say that our president is on a rhetorical offensive as well, I think North Korea's strategy although it's opaque to us, I think there's some things that we can assess. First of all, the rapidity of the missile tests and the nuclear test in September, I think may be designed for three purposes. The first is perhaps to keep the United States and South Korea off balance and preventing the alliance from implementing new policies and new strategies. So that could be one. They certainly have us reacting to the missile tests and the nuclear tests, as well as the rhetoric. The second may be the North Korean hope that the Chinese proposal for a freeze, will take effect. And, of course, that's freezing the nuclear program as well as really stopping the ROC-US readiness exercises that are designed to ensure the readiness of the alliance forces to be able to deter and defend the ROC from an attack from the north. And what North Korea may be doing is to try to rapidly advance to the highest level its missile and nuclear capabilities so when if they do have a freeze, their program will be at the most advanced stages possible. Of course, I don't think the U.S. and the ROC will agree to a freeze for freeze, but that may be factoring into Kim Jong-un's thinking. And, of course, the third, which is not often talked about, is for domestic political legitimacy inside North Korea, as well as to maintain the support of the military. We tend to think that every action that North Korea takes is directed towards us, and while it's easy to see that from and to take that from our position, from our point of view, sometimes these events are merely to demonstrate their capabilities in order to ensure support at home and particularly support of the military, which Kim Jong-un absolutely needs. The support of the military to stay in power. So those are kind of the three large reasons why we may have seen, the frequency of tests as well as the sixth nuclear test. Now, of course, the other reason is they simply are at the point where they can conduct tests to advance their missile programs. And, and they could be doing it simply to advance their program with no intention for any external influence, though I think that most every time that they take a strategic demonstration which is what we should call their missile and nuclear tests, not provocations, but strategic demonstrations, you know, they are to achieve some kind of influence effect. So I think that's, you know, I can talk more about the situation and the strategy. Let me just end on one point. From open source reporting, we have seen no military mobilization on either side of the DMZ. We don't see forces going to a higher state of alert and readiness, although we, the United States, of course, has deployed strategic assets and, both air and naval assets as to demonstrate strategic reassurance and strategic resolve. But we've seen no mobilization, no forces on higher alert. And, of course, the North, not having satellites, not having high-tech ISR, depends on their human intelligence network, their spies in South Korea, to be able to observe what the Iraq and U.S. military are doing. And hopefully, since both sides are not mobilizing, that doesn't mean, or that means that we are not on an imminent path to war, which I hope we are not on such a path.
And so when you think about the situation right now, there's a lot of back and forth between U.S. commentary about North Korea and how they're trying to have a missile that reaches the States and so forth. But, this is a broader issue. So what is the strategy in dealing with North Korea, and how does that incorporate into broader U.S. policies in regards to East Asia and the Pacific? Because we have this whole region, neighbors of North Korea, that have a huge stake in what's going on.
Before I answer that question, let me describe the North Korean strategy, and then if I don't answer your question, come back to that, and I'll talk about China, Russia, Japan, South Korea. But I think it's important to understand North Korea's perspective. And of course, I might sound like I'm speaking with authority. I'm pretty passionate about this, but there are no real North Korean experts. We're all students of North Korea, trying to understand the opaqueness. Look through the opacity of the regime. So you can say, you can take what I say certainly with a grain of salt. But we know that the vital national interest of the Kim family regime is survival of the regime, not survival of the nation state, not survival of the Korean people living in the North. So survival is what they are after. We know when Wang Jung-yap, who was the highest-ranking defector from North Korea, the father of Juche ideology, when he defected in 1997, we asked him why the North has invested all of this, all of their resources in their military, but has not resumed hostilities, has not restarted the Korean War that has only been suspended by an armistice. And of course, he looked at us and he said, American nuclear weapons. We can't win a nuclear war against the United States. And if there is a war, they believe the United States will use nuclear weapons. And furthermore, they believe that the United States will not attack another nuclear-armed nation. So they look at nuclear weapons first and foremost from a deterrence perspective. And it is to deter an attack by the United States. Second, their nuclear weapons and their missile programs support their blackmail diplomacy, where they can conduct strategic demonstrations or provocations to gain political and economic concessions. And we've seen them do that for the last 60 years. Of course, nuclear tests only since 2006, but provocations on the DMZ, ratcheting up tensions, all designed to gain political and economic concessions. And so it supports their blackmail diplomacy. But also in their strategy, what they and what is often overlooked, because we hear that they are interested in survival, so they're not suicidal, so they're not going to attack. But what we really have to understand is the second part of their strategy. They believe that they must unify the peninsula under their control to ensure their survival. And so their strategy is focused on unification. And a lot of people will laugh and say, well, there's not going to be unification. North and South are so different. But from the North's perspective, they have to unify. And to do that, they need to do, they need one key condition, and that's U.S. forces off the peninsula. And so, as part of their strategy for the last 60 years, they have continually tried to drive a wedge in the ROK-U.S. alliance. and they want to split the alliance, and they want U.S. forces off the peninsula, because what that will do is allow them to execute their strategy, which is two-pronged, which is both coercion and force. And so they believe that if they have nuclear weapons, the alliance is split, and there are no U.S. forces on the peninsula, that they will be able to coerce the ROC into unification, that they will be able to threaten with nuclear weapons, as well as they have also been executing a 60-plus year subversion campaign in the ROC. And they believe that they have infiltrated agents of influence into the South, and they want to get to a point where politically there is enough political will in the South to support unification under the North's control. Now, I don't think that that is very likely, but that, I think, is their strategy. And so subversion and coercion will lead to unification. And then if that fails, then they have a campaign plan to execute an attack of the South and reunify the peninsula by force. And so while we look at their nuclear program to deter a United States attack, and you know, we know that survival of the Kim family regime is their vital national interest, and so we say they're not suicidal, we have to remember that the actions that we take diplomatically, whether we recognize them, we come to a peace treaty, we withdraw forces, we have to remember the second part of the strategy, which is unification of the peninsula under their control, either through coercion or by force. And so as we are executing diplomatic strategies or a national or a strategy against the North, we have to remember what their strategy is. And so how does that figure in with the and how does China and Russia, Japan and Korea figure into this? Well, you know, first of all, China is the 600-pound gorilla or the elephant in the room in Asia. And of course, I think what China wants, I think China is, you know, a very conservative country, and it first and foremost wants to maintain the status quo. And so their policy of three no's, no war, no instability or collapse on the peninsula, and no nuclear weapons. That's been their three no's, and of course, we have to say that they're a pretty good baseball team because they're batting 600. They've got two out of three, no war and no collapse to this point. They failed, like everybody, on nuclear weapons. China wants to maintain the status quo. And I think that they're going to take action to do that in any situation. They're trying to maintain the status quo. And I think what's changed for them is their view of the potential for United States action. Because of our rhetoric, the discussions about preemptive strike, preventative war, they, I think, have a genuine concern that President Trump may take action. And so while we have seen an increase in North Korean missile tests and their nuclear tests, we've also seen China be almost the most supportive of international sanctions, UN sanctions, and actions to try to reduce tensions and to try to put pressure on North Korea to cease its actions. I think that the reason China is doing that is not to denuclearize North Korea. It is to maintain the status quo, but it's also to send a signal to us that they are taking sufficient actions to try to reduce tensions in order to prevent us from conducting a preemptive strike or a preventative war. So I don't think we can count on China to solve our security problem on the Korean Peninsula. All of the talk about them, forcing North Korea back to the negotiating table to denuclearize, that is not realistic. And of course, today we see that Secretary Mattis went to the DMZ and made statements about what a war, what a catastrophe war would be. And he said that our goal is denuclearization through diplomacy. The North response was denuclearization is not going to happen. They have written it in their constitution that they're a nuclear power, and they are going to maintain their nuclear capability and continue to develop it until they have the capability to strike the United States in order to have the strongest possible deterrent capability to prevent a U.S. attack. Now, Russia, of course, I think is the spoiler. And I think given the state of Russian and United States relations now, I think we're going to see Russia take action to try to undercut U.S. legitimacy in Northeast Asia in any way possible. Now, they only have a 17-kilometer border with North Korea. They don't have the forces really to affect things directly on the ground. But, of course, air and naval forces are there, and we are seeing Russian actions in the Kuril Islands now. You know, the claims to the Kuril Islands in northern Japan, we're seeing activity there, and I think that that is an action that may be designed to influence the region and, of course, influence Japan because they're directly affected by that. You know, they both have claims to the islands up there, and so I think that Russia is going to act as a spoiler, both from a security perspective and diplomatically, certainly in the UN Security Council. But like China, I think that they have, you know, they had to go along with these last UN Security Council resolutions because, you know, despite them wanting to be a spoiler, I think, you know, logically, Russia, China, Japan, South Korea, and the United States do not want war. And I think that's really something that we all can agree on, that war on the Korean Peninsula will be unlike anything we have seen since the end of the Korean War, or since the Korean War was suspended in 1953. But a war on the peninsula will look a lot like World War II and the Korean War, and will be far worse than any conflict we've been involved with, that Russia, China, the United States, South Korea, and Japan have been involved with since 1953. The amount of death and destruction that will occur if there is a war will just be on a scale that is difficult for us to imagine. Now, of course, Japan is a key player, and of course, Prime Minister Abe was just reelected. There has been long talk about changing their constitution from the pacifist constitution and changing their military from simply a self-defense capability to giving them capabilities to act as part of a coalition and to take take offensive action in defense of their country. You know, the relations between South Korea and Japan still remain tense over historical issues. Obviously, the colonization of Korea by Japan, the comfort women issue, that hinders the trilateral relations that are really necessary for effective deterrence and, if necessary, to conduct operations. It would be wonderful if we could have a trilateral alliance, South Korea, Japan, and the United States, but given the historical issues, that's difficult. There has been, you know, recently the joint information sharing, intelligence sharing agreement between South Korea and Japan. That was very politically sensitive. And while that's a step in the right direction, we really need to move to integrated missile defense to be able to harness both the detection capabilities of radars, you know, the sensors, the ISR of all three countries, as well as the missile defense capabilities, and to have an integrated ability to cue, target, and destroy missiles that will threaten the ROC and the Japan and Japan. And so that would be a good thing. But of course, in the South, you know, the political situation is such that people will say, why should we contribute to defending Japan? And, you know, it's difficult to explain to the general populace that an integrated missile defense that would of course benefit Japan would provide greater benefit to South Korea than just a bilateral defense missile defense supporting the defense of the ROC. So I'll stop there and And I can talk further if you have if you want me to elaborate any more.
Well, you mentioned alliances, and one of my questions is, what is the state of the United States alliance with South Korea and Japan, since we do have fairly decent relations with both countries, and this definitely factors into the whole situation we have at hand with North Korea?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that the U.S.-Japanese alliance is as strong as it's ever been. Of course, there are tensions with U.S. forces on Okinawa, but as a general statement, the Japanese-U.S. alliance is strong. And I think the re-election of Abe, will mean that this alliance will be sustained through his tenure. And I think that that's very important. I mean, some people would say that Japan is our 11th aircraft carrier, the unsinkable aircraft carrier in the Pacific, and it's important with seven United Nations bases where U.S. forces are based in Japan, and Japan is critical to the United States' ability to be able to fight a war on the Korean Peninsula. It will serve as an intermediate staging base, as a logistics resupply. U.S. aircraft based in Japan will be able to fly out of there and fly out of Japan to attack targets in the north. So the Japanese-U.S. alliance is critical, and it is strong. Now, the ROK-U.S. alliance is strong, but clearly there are tensions. As a result of actions really by both presidents, President Trump's call to cancel or at least try to renegotiate the CORUS FTA, the free trade agreement, certainly puts tensions on the alliance. There is, of course, the THAAD deployment, which is a self-defense measure that defends U.S. forces as well as South Korea from missile attack from the north. That's been very controversial, and it's very controversial because China has reacted strongly against South Korea for its decision to allow the deployment of THAAD. And so they have taken economic actions against South Korean firms in China, manufacturing, retail, entertainment have all been impacted because of the South Korean decision. And of course, China looks at THAAD as a threat to it because the radars can range into Chinese territory. But we should keep in mind that it's only a threat to China if China plans on using its missiles to attack South Korea. I mean, there's THAAD doesn't have an offensive capability. It's a defensive capability. And yes, its radars can range into Chinese territory, but we have many more ISR capabilities that can see into China than a THAAD radar. But China is exploiting the deployment of THAAD, for political purposes and really it is trying to pressure South Korea, to affect the United States deployment of that weapon system. So there is friction within the alliance. President Moon has just the Security Consultative meeting is taking place in Seoul right now. Secretary Mattis and General Dunford are there, and President Moon has called for a change to the command structure, and this is known as OPCON transfer, which actually started in January of 2003, when Secretary Rumsfeld really initiated this, and the idea was that this so-called wartime OPCON would be transferred to South Korea, and U.S. forces would move out of Yongsan down to Pyeongtaek, the city of Pyeongtaek, in the U.S. camp called Camp Humphreys. And the majority of ground forces and headquarters would consolidate there, and this has been underway since 2003. and the facilities are nearing completion, and they are some U.S. forces are repositioning there. But this OPCON transfer is a source of friction. And while the U.S. Has long supported it, over time the South Koreans have requested delay, and then in 2015, both countries agreed to delay the decision until the conditions are right. And so while from 2003 to 2015, there always had been a designated time for OPCON transfer, in 2015 it became conditions-based. And those conditions being that the ROK military would develop the independent warfighting capabilities necessary to operate independently. And one thing we should know about the alliance, since the establishment of the ROK-U.S. Combined Forces Command in 1978, the intent and the purpose of the command has been to bring together the strengths of both nations where they have comparative advantage and to be able to fight as an alliance and, of course, to overcome the weaknesses of both. As an example, the United States brings intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance capabilities, C4I capabilities, logistics capabilities. Both countries have tremendous air capabilities. You know, South Korean Air Force, of course, is based on F-16, F-15 aircraft, U.S. aircraft, and they are an advanced air power nation. So both the combined air forces bring tremendous power. You know, the ROK Navy is very strong, but the preponderance of naval forces, and of course all the carrier battle groups, will come from the United States. The amphibious capability, while there are two divisions of ROK Marines, the majority of amphibious capability will be brought by the United States, and along with a division of U.S. Marines. But ground forces consist primarily of ROK forces. You know, they have 650,000 forces, and the majority of armor, of infantry, will be ROK forces. And the ROK forces will do the bulk of the ground fighting. And then, of course, the counterfire fight. This is the fight against North Korean artillery. The hundreds and hundreds of artillery pieces that are aligned along the DMZ, many of which can range Seoul. There is a what we call a counterfire fight, an ability for the South Korean artillery, U.S. artillery, tied together through a network designed by the United States, employing artillery, rockets, and air power to be able to destroy the North Korean artillery should they come out of their underground facilities and start firing artillery at Seoul and throughout the South. And so the alliance has been optimized to be able to work together, employing the strengths of both sides. To split that, and that's really what the OPCON transfer is all about, is splitting the alliance into separate commands, which, as most military people will tell you, that's not advisable to not have unity of command and unity of effort. And so if you split the commands, then you have you're going to weaken the alliance military capability. The combined command is, you know, one of the finest combined organizations in the entire world, and really in many ways superior to NATO, because it's only the two countries. You know, NATO has all the nations there, but it is probably the finest combined command and most effective and efficient combined command that's really ever existed. And to split that in the face of the very real threat from the North puts the, you know, will weaken the alliance. And so all these factors are, you know, are impacting on the alliance. That said, you know, over the last 60 years, there has been friction in the alliance, ups and downs. You know, during the time of the progressive Kim Dae-jung and Noh Myo-hoon and U.S. President Bush, Bush II, you know, different political views, yet the alliance prevailed and remained strong. And so now, while there will be differences in the alliance, I'm optimistic that the alliance will remain strong and we will get through these areas of friction.
Going back to Russia, I understand the interests of the neighbors of North Korea, but what is Russia's stake in all of this? What do they gain or lose from dealing with North Korea?
Well, of course, they have historical ties, and I think that Russia, as I said, would like to be a spoiler. I think Russia would like to have a say in what happens after North Korea no longer exists. You know, at some point, if there is war or if there is regime collapse, there's going to be a new arrangement on the peninsula, which I think should be a reunified peninsula, under a United Republic of Korea. But both China and Russia, and to extent Japan, will all want to be able to have a say in what happens. Now, I think, I've been to many Track 2 events, with Chinese, Russian, Japanese, South Koreans, and U.S. Delegations, and, most admit that unification under the South is acceptable and is what will really happen. Even though some people say, China wants a buffer zone, China doesn't won't allow unification, I don't think anybody is going to prevent unification, because nobody else wants to take on the burden of unification. I mean, China is not going to absorb North Korea. Russia certainly is not going to absorb North Korea. They don't want the financial burden. However, China, I think, will allow unification, and really has two objectives in a unified Korea. One is continued access to the resources that are in North Korea. They've been taking out 50 and 100 year leases for mineral rights in North Korea. So, China's extraction economy wants to continue to be able to extract from the North. The second, though, and their real objective vis-a-vis the United States, is U.S. forces off the Korean Peninsula. They will accept a unified peninsula, but they don't want U.S. forces on the peninsula. So their long-term objective will be getting U.S. forces off the peninsula, and that is how we will see them act diplomatically. And I think what you'll see is that if there is war or collapse on the peninsula, then Chinese forces will intervene inside North Korea, but then they will say to the United Republic of Korea that we think all foreign forces should be out of the peninsula. We'll leave. You should send America home. And of course, the irony in that situation is the demands for U.S. forces to leave the peninsula may be strongest coming from the population of the United States, who will say, if there's a unified Korea, why do we need forces on the peninsula anyways? But I am not an advocate of prematurely saying that U.S. forces will withdraw from the peninsula. I think that needs to be a decision of the unified Korea and the United States, and what is best for both nations. Should the alliance be maintained? Should forces remain there? And what I always recommend to my Korean colleagues is that they should tell the Chinese that the future of the alliance will be condition-based, based on the security conditions of the peninsula and the region, and that will determine the nature and the state of the ROC-U.S. alliance. But Russia, I think, wants to be able to also have access to resources. Some years ago they have talked about a pipeline from Russia to South Korea that would go through North Korea, an oil pipeline. They, of course, want to benefit economically, but I think that that we will see them act in a way that will allow them access to resources, allow them political influence, and if the current U.S.-Russian relationships persist, they will do what they can to minimize U.S. Influence in the region, and they too would support China in trying to have U.S. forces removed from the Korean Peninsula. Any reduction of U.S. forces and thus U.S. influence in the region will be to both China and Russia's benefit.
And I have a question which I feel like transitions nicely with what you were just saying, because I have a feeling I know what you're going to say, but I still want to ask it. So hypothetically, if it does come to war between North Korea and potentially the US, in your opinion, where would China stand? They have a huge stake in the peninsula and the region. So do you think they'd take a side or not?
Well, they've made recent statements to that effect, but first let me disabuse you of one notion. There will not be war between North Korea and the U.S. only. We've got this is not like Iraq and Afghanistan. If there is a war, it will be against North Korea against South Korea and the U.S. There can be no war on the peninsula that leaves South Korea out. South Korea, I mean, South Korea will be the battleground. And the U.S. cannot go to North Korea militarily without support from South Korea. We could not project force, even if we use Japan to project force, we could not project force into North Korea without the support of South Korea. But if there is a war and North Korea attacks, they will be attacking South Korea. They also can't, except when they develop their ICBM that can reach the United States, they can't directly attack the United States with, certainly with ground or sufficient military or air power or naval power, naval and air power. So please understand that there is no such thing as just a war between North Korea and the United States. Now, how would China act? Now, recently, they have made they've reiterated statements they've made in the past. If the South and the United States attack North Korea, they will defend North Korea as part of their alliance. But they have said in recent months that if North Korea initiates a war, they will not support it. They will not support the North, and which I think is logical from their perspective because. There will be no way for them to support North Korea and for North Korea to achieve success on the peninsula. I mean, when there is if there is war, the ROK-US alliance will prevail, and China does not want to get into a shooting war with the United States. And although China wants to maintain the status quo, once Kim Jong-un changes that status quo. China is going to seek a different strategic calculus. They will accept, as I said, unification, and then they will try to achieve their long-term objectives. And their long-term objectives do not include, maintaining North Korea, forever. Or they will try to maintain it for as long as possible, but they recognize North Korea is not going to exist as it is forever, and that they have to be prepared for their long-term objectives, which again include the U.S. forces not on the Korean mainland.
So to minimize the tensions and potential war in the region, what kind of leverage does the US have on North Korea? Of course, we always hear of sanctions. Are these sanctions actually having any effect? What is your opinion on US leverage and sanctions and so forth?
Yes, well, sanctions are important, although we have to, again, keep in mind that sanctions have not in the past changed North Korean behavior, and they're unlikely to until they get to a point where the regime is really threatened. North Korea has proved to be very resilient, and the problem with sanctions is that for decades, North Korea has been able to get around them, both because China allowed them to get around them, and because North Korea has developed a global illicit network that traffics in illicit drugs, in counterfeit drugs, in counterfeit cigarettes, in counterfeit money. It projects slave labor around the world, and all of this gains hard currency for the regime outside of the international system. What is really interesting is that it has only been in this last year that we have really imposed sanctions on North Korea that are really that really have a strong effect. I mean, sanctions on specific industries, on companies, on people and the use of international financial instruments, those, you know, if we had done these back in the 90s during the time of the agreed framework, when we made that agreed framework based on an erroneous assumption that North Korea was going to collapse in the 90s, and thus we didn't have to worry about it. If we had implemented those kind of sanctions, we would have prevented the development of its missile and nuclear programs. And so the sanctions, while they will not necessarily change behavior, are important now because it cuts off support for the hard currency it needs, both to maintain the allegiance of the regime elite, but more importantly, to support their missile and nuclear program. Again, it may be kind of closing the barn door after the horses have left, but sanctions are important because they still need money to continue to progress in their missile and nuclear capabilities. So sanctions are important, but they must be combined with shutting down North Korea's illicit activities around the world. They have what they call Department or Office 39 that launders money and that conducts all these illicit activities. And, you know, North Korean diplomats are violating both local laws in the countries in which they're operating and, of course, international law by using their diplomatic status for illegal activities. And what we really need to do is to conduct what I call a strategic strangulation campaign to be able to shut off access to these illicit activities. And what is very interesting is that since June, we have seen Mexico, Peru, Philippines, I think the UAE, and a number of countries both expelling diplomats, cutting off and forcing North Korean laborers to return home, you know, who are, I mean, they're suffering human rights atrocities or human rights violations by working in third countries for slave wages and the wages are going directly to the regime. And so we're seeing the U.S. and South Korean diplomatic corps influencing countries around the world to take action against the North. And these actions, you know, will have the long-term effect of cutting off external funding for the regime. And then at that point, you know, we may see some changes in behavior, although, you know, I think we also have to expect before we see changes in behavior that we will see the North actually conduct provocations, probably kinetic provocations, to try to break that. And of course, the worst case is that losing access to the external funding and the resources for the regime could cause internal conflict inside the regime if the elite and the military no longer continue to support Kim Jong-un and the Kim family regime. And then we see another complex and dangerous problem, and that would be regime collapse.
And on that note, how stable is the regime at this point in time? It seems from the bits of news that we get from North Korea that, you know, all seems stable and happy, but is there a reality that potentially it might not be?
Well, again, that is something we just don't know, and we have to look and compare to history and compare what we've seen in the last 6 years in the assumption of power of Kim Jong-un, and compare that to when his father, Kim Jong-il, was designated as the successor to Kim Il-sung. That was in 1973. Kim Il-sung designated Kim Jong-il as his successor and put him in charge of the Organization and Guidance Department, which is the center of power inside the Korean Workers' Party. It controls all assignments, all promotions, who gets purged, who goes to the political prison camps, you know, who is executed. All of that is centralized at the Organization and Guidance Department. Kim Jong-il took control of that in 1973, and for 21 years, he purged his opponents, and he cleared the decks. And so when Kim Il-sung died on July 6, 1994, Kim Jong-il was already running the country, had already eliminated his opposition. And, of course, during that 21 years, the purges that occurred happened in, you know, benign events, drownings in March, car accidents, things like that. Now, whereas Kim Jong-un was designated probably as early as 2009, maybe not, maybe as late as 2010, you know, he only had maybe a year or two as a designated successor and had no time to purge his opposition. And so what we have seen for the last 6 years are very violent purges. You know, it appears that things are stable because he's ruling, ruling by terror. I mean, when you execute your uncle, who was the designated regent, using 14.5 millimeter air-to-aircraft guns, that sends a pretty powerful message. And so while people may be at the point now where they fear for their lives and so they remain loyal because, you know, they want to survive, this should be troubling to us in terms of decision-making, particularly in crisis. And this is what I worry about from Kim Jong-un. 33 years old, has some Western education in Switzerland. I worry that he may have a sense of arrogance that he has some Western education and thinks he might understand the outside world, but yet he's very inexperienced. And now, because of this rule by terror, he has people around him that, in order to survive, believe they have to tell him what they think he wants to hear. You know, so the emperor wears no clothes. And I never thought I would say this, but things were a lot more stable with Kim Jong-il because I think he understood the correlation of forces between North and South and what would happen in war. And I worry that Kim Jong-un does not have that same understanding because he does not have any experts around him that are telling him the truth about his military capabilities in relation to the South and the South and the U.S. military capabilities. And in times of crisis, that could lead him to make what we would consider an irrational decision, but from his perspective, it could be very rational based on the information that he has, which could be to launch an attack, which obviously, as Secretary Mattis said today, would be a catastrophe, and that's what we don't want to happen. And so, therefore, we must deter him, and we must demonstrate strength. The one thing that he has learned from his father and his grandfather is that you don't attack strength. And that you've got to weaken the alliance, separate the alliance in order to be successful. And so that's why it's imperative for us to demonstrate strategic reassurance and strategic resolve by having a strong military presence, deploying strategic assets to be able to show to him that we have the will and the capability to defeat him should he attack the South.
Well, I think that is a perfect transition, Mr. Maxwell, into something as a new guest you don't know, but we tend to, if time permits, like to give our guests a moment to maybe touch on something that we might not have touched on or have a final thought. So I want to hand the floor over to you for that.
Oh, well, you've caught me by surprise. All right. So when I look at the Korean situation, I like to talk about the Big Five. To summarize the situation. Of course, number one is war. That is the first priority. We must deter war, but if deterrence fails, we have to defend the South, fight, and win. All right, so war is number one. Number two is regime collapse. And while some people think that regime collapse is benign, I think that there will be, in any collapse scenario, there will be some form of conflict. And of course, the most dangerous thing about regime collapse is that if faced with collapse, and given that survival of the Kim family regime is the single vital national interest, he could make the decision, a rational decision from his perspective, to execute his campaign plan to unify the peninsula by force in order to ensure his survival. Now, again, that wouldn't happen, but from his perspective, that may be his only option. And so we have to plan and prepare for that that potential eventuality. The third, and I haven't talked about this at all, and I really have to emphasize this, is human rights and the crimes against humanity. In 2014, Justice Kirby from Australia led the United Nations Commission of Inquiry, and documented the human rights atrocities that are being committed on a scale that we really haven't seen since World War II by a nation state to such a sustained in such a sustained manner of violating human rights and committing crimes against humanity. The atrocities that are being committed against the Korean people in the north are just too brutal to comprehend. With the prison camps, the purges, and just the Songbun, which is the classification of society, 51 classes of society that are you know that prevails and rules the entire lives of people. So human rights are really important, and just like Ronald Reagan, you know, said the evil empire. And people heard that in the gulags of the Soviet Union, you know, and were given hope because of that. It's important for us to emphasize human rights for the Korean people living in the North. When you talk to defectors, they tell us that the people need to know that we know that they are suffering. And so it's important for us to focus on human rights to give them hope. I mean, it is a moral imperative, but there's a practical aspect to this as well. Something that we should keep in mind as we talk about the nuclear threats and the nuclear their nuclear program, it legitimizes the regime. It demonstrates from the regime's perspective that we fear their nuclear weapons, and that reinforces regime legitimacy. Whereas when the Commission of Inquiry report came out, and every time we talk about human rights, it undermines the legitimacy of the regime. It's a threat to the regime. And when the regime, when the Commission of Inquiry came out, the regime did what everybody does. You know, they denied everything and made counter-accusations. You know, they talked about South Korean human rights. And because talking about human rights in North Korea is a threat to them. And so therefore, we must talk about it. And we must plan for all the human rights issues that are going to come about in unification. You know, to include transitional justice and the like. So human rights is number three. Number four are the asymmetric threats. And I lump the asymmetric threats in these categories. The nuclear program, the missile program, its cyber capabilities, its special operations capabilities, and, as I've talked about, its global illicit activities network that supports the regime. These asymmetric capabilities are really the key to its survival, its ability to operate, and they will be critical to war fighting as well. So we have to address the asymmetric capabilities. But what I don't want to do is just solely focus on the nuclear threat. The nuclear threat is a symptom of the problem, and of course that problem is the existence of the Kim family regime, which brings me to the fifth. The number five of my big five, and that is unification. Unification is really the only way that we are going to see an end of the nuclear program, an end of the threat, an end to the crimes against humanity that are being perpetrated by what we call a mafia-like crime family cult called the Kim family regime. And it is only through unification that we will see an end to this. To the threat on the Korean Peninsula, and unification is what will bring stability and prosperity to Northeast Asia. And so this should be what our focus is. In 2009, President Imanbak and President Obama stated that the alliance vision was peaceful unification. President Obama and President Park reaffirmed that twice, and President Trump and President Moon again reaffirmed peaceful unification as the vision for the alliance on June 30th of 2017. Now, of course, whether it's peaceful or not is going to be determined by Kim Jong-un, because the enemy has a vote. But whether it's peaceful or whether it's through conflict, unification must be the acceptable, durable political arrangement that will ultimately achieve ROC and U.S. strategic objectives for peace and prosperity on the Korean Peninsula.
Well, thank you so, so much for coming on the Loopcast, Mr. Maxwell. I've really enjoyed speaking with you. I know our listeners are going to be well informed on the subject now. And just thank you for spending time with us.
Well, it was an honor and a pleasure, and I hope that you know, I hope that we all will focus on this problem and give it the strategic thought, whether you know you're an academic, a government official, or an American citizen. This is a problem that's going to affect everybody if there is conflict and war on the Korean Peninsula. So we should do everything we can to prevent that. And again, as I said, achieve unification, because that is the only end to this problem. Thank you.
Thank you.